Okay. The strong interactions are believed to be described by an SU3 gauge theory. Of course, in four dimensions. With quarks, which are fermions in the fundamental representation of SU3. So there are different kinds of quarks with different masses. And this theory has got a variety of very strange facts, features that are seen experimentally. Well, the strange fact that we've mentioned already, in most detail maybe, is the mass gap. Well, one of them is the mass gap. And the mass gap is related to the fact that even though there are gauge fields in the Lagrangian, we don't see particles associated with the gauge fields. Those gauge fields should go with massless particles, just like the electromagnetic field goes with a massless photon. We don't see such particles. And we don't see individual quarks, even though quarks appear in the Lagrangian. So what you can do experimentally, here I'll plot a picture where time goes on. You can, for example, take particles you do know about, like electrons and positrons, annihilate them into an electromagnetic wave, which then turns into a quark and antiquark sometimes. That produces a highly energetic quark and antiquark, which you would think would escape and appear at infinity or at the detector as particles. But it doesn't work that way. No matter how much energy you pump in to create a quark and antiquark pair, you never get an isolated quark making it to the detector. What always ends up at the detector is a meson, consisting of a quark and antiquark. What happens is something a little bit like this. A QQ bar pair is always spontaneously produced in such a way that arises that what arrives at one detector or the other is not a quark or an antiquark by themselves, but a color-neutral object consisting of a quark and an antiquark. You always get a collection of particles from which you could make the trivial representation of SU3. The detector never detects non-trivial SU3 representations, so to speak. Or even without trying to observe SU3, it never detects individual quarks without antiquarks. Sometimes, instead of precisely what I've drawn, well, what I've drawn is incomplete in a few ways. For one thing, sometimes you'll get this. Where what appears at either detector is a proton or an antiproton, for example, made from three quarks. The number three being here because the group SU3 has the property that in the cubic product of the three-dimensional representation, you can make an SU3 invariant. So three quarks are just as good as a quark and an antiquark. The more fundamental, well, from a practical experimental point of view, the main thing, which is wrong about what I said, is that if you pump in a lot of energy, what will really happen in practice is much more complicated than anything I've drawn. There'll be, well, chaos. A little bit more realistic version is this. There'll be lots of quark antiquark pairs produced. And to do justice to it, you need your detector to cover a lot of 4 pi. Because the particles will go out in all different directions. But wherever you see anything in your detector, you'll always see not a single quark, but one of these pairs, or pairs or triples or something. But whatever it is, they always correspond to trivial representations of SU3. So, well, going back to the simple picture, pumping in more energy fails to enable the detector to see the isolated quark. That's interpreted heuristically, to begin with, to mean that if you try to separate a quark from an antiquark with nothing else happening, the energy would grow too much, would grow indefinitely as you try to separate them, so that no amount of energy is enough. Unless something else happens, And what happens, eventually, is that your purpose is defeated by the production of additional pairs. Now, the production of additional pairs is an interesting phenomenon, but it's something we know about in quantum field theory. Matter and antimatter gets created and annihilated all the time in quantum field theory. The surprising phenomenon here is that you can't separate the quark and antiquark by themselves because of the fact that the energy would have grown. And to isolate the surprising phenomenon, it's convenient to consider not the real theory, but an auxiliary theory that doesn't have the quarks. So, we consider the theory without quarks. But we imagine that we've got a test quark at our disposal. If it bothers you to imagine doing a thought experiment with a particle that you're able to introduce into the vacuum that isn't part of the theory, then I give you high marks for your progress in learning physics. However, in case this has happened, to reassure you, I will say that we could imagine that instead of just getting rid of the quarks, we've taken their masses to be millions of tons, for example, much bigger than any characteristic energy scale in the theory. And we imagine that in the Big Bang, a single quark-antiquark pair weighing millions of tons was created and has been stored in museums ever since. And although we consider fantastically large energies compared to characteristic QCD scale, we don't get up to the range of tons. That is, we don't reach elementary particles whose energies correspond to mc squared, with m being a ton. So at that rate, we would only be studying the relic quarks left in the Big Bang, which we move around with very powerful tweezers, and we carefully preserve in museums, because if they annihilate, we won't be able to make more. And so we have a physical situation where we can study external test quarks, but we don't have to worry about spontaneous quark-antiquark creation. So now we're in a situation where... Actually, I think I'm going to let time run vertically now. Now we have a situation where, in space, we've got a quark and an antiquark that we've gotten from somewhere, and they're fixed in space, and we just ask how the rest of the theory responds to it. Well, we believe that the essence of the experimental phenomenon in the theory that does have light quarks is that in this hypothetical theory, the energy of separation, the energy of a system with the quark and antiquark separated by distance r, increases, first of all, with r. That would be enough to account for the crude observation as I've explained it. But for a variety of reasons, it's believed more specifically that E behaves for large r like a constant times r, a positive constant, C. So, what I'm discussing here is a concrete mathematical question. There's a definite theory, and I'm making a definite assertion about it. And this assertion is, among other things, tested by computer simulations. So there's a lot of evidence that it's correct. The problem is to get a better theoretical understanding of why it's correct. It's a more precise statement than we needed for the crude experiment. But there are a lot of reasons. Long before there were computer simulations, people guessed that linear behavior for reasons I'll try to explain. Well, you see, quarks are hard to understand because they're charges in a non-abelian gauge theory. So we might first practice with an abelian gauge theory. So now we go back to electrons and positrons. Well, electrons and positrons are sources of an electric field. That field is given by a 1 over r squared force law. Well, it has several characteristics. But one of the equations is that the divergence of the electric field is the charge density, which we imagine to be the charge of the E plus, which I'll call it Q, times the delta function of wherever the E plus is, minus Q times the other delta function. So this equation implies that if you integrate star E, the two form, over any two sphere that encloses the positron, you get a total electric flux of Q. So the electric field through any such two sphere can't be zero. It integrates to Q. And the actual electric flux in this experiment will be the minimum, the energy, the total energy in the electric field will be the integral of E squared over 8 pi. And the actual electric field will be the minimum of this function subject to the constraint that on any such two sphere the integral is Q. You can find it in a well-known fashion by solving a certain differential equation. After all, you can and the answer is, of course, given by the sum of the Coulomb fields of the two charges. Well, at least heuristically, in the case of the non-equally engaged theory, where we now put let's imagine now that we had not the ordinary vacuum, but an extraordinary vacuum which expelled electric flux. Suppose that the energy function, the energy of an electric field, didn't grow like this, but that for some reason electric flux was forbidden in the vacuum. So it's so counterfactual for electromagnetism that it sounds confusing, so we'll have to give different examples in a moment where something similar happens. Well, if you had a vacuum in which electric flux wasn't allowed, it would, of course, be impossible to evade this equation. So we might just conclude that physics was impossible. But now imagine that although the vacuum expels electric flux at a finite cost and energy per unit volume, you can create an extraordinary state of matter where electric flux is allowed. In that case, you can see that what would happen is that the extraordinary state would have to be present in a tube here. And to obey our integral condition on the total electric flux, the electric field will have to be concentrated in this tube. Well, how thin will the tube be? Well, we'd like to make it thin because there will be a cost in energy in creating that extraordinary state of matter where electric fields can penetrate. But it won't do to make it too thin because then the electric field will be too strong. And then the integral of E squared will be too big. So there will be a distinguished solution with the characteristic thickness of that tube. And then that tube will have a certain characteristic energy per unit length. And so the energy of separating an electron and positron will grow linearly with the distance. Well, that doesn't happen for electromagnetism, but it's believed to be what happens in the case of non-equally engaged theory in four dimensions. I started with SU3 as an example. But it's believed to happen in every case where the question makes sense. Suppose the question, we started with a quark. So let's just erase these electrons and positrons and replace them with quarks and antiquarks, where we actually posed the question. Suppose this question, we used the fact that we could introduce an object, namely the quark, in the three-dimensional representation of SU3. And we could ask that quarks not be present in the theory, only external objects. Well, the representation we can't avoid is the adjoint representation. So we've used the fact that the three-dimensional representation doesn't arise in the tensor product of many copies of the adjoint representation. So what we really use is the fact that the adjoint group of SU3, which is SU3 mod Z3, has non-trivial pi 1. And in particular, is not trivial.
Where did you use
reference? Well, we used that at the beginning. I snuck it in on you when we discussed quarks. The quark was in the three-dimensional representation.
Yeah.
See, to get something clean where we could discuss the pure phenomenon that the energy grows linearly, separated from the interesting but more standard phenomenon of matter-antimatter creation, we considered a test quark in a theory that didn't have any quarks floating around. Now, if we tried to use a quark in the adjoint representation, it wouldn't have worked, because the theory contains, anyway, fields in the adjoint representation corresponding to the gauge fields. We call them gluons for QCD. So then we would have gotten the matter-antimatter creation with gluons. And the detector would have observed a quark plus a gluon. So we would have had the same phenomenon as in the real world, that whatever you observe isn't what you tried to create, but is a SU3 neutral combination. But we wouldn't have gotten a situation where we could probe the pure linear energy suppressing the matter-antimatter creation. Is that clear?
So you say you're using...
If we're planning to discuss gauge theory, we have particles in the adjoint representation, which we start with. We can't avoid having the gauge fields.
Right.
So anything that can arise in the tensor product of many copies of the adjoint representation can be screened.
Mm-hmm.
That means whatever it is, together with a certain number of gluons, you could make a color-neutral combination. So we'd have gained nothing. We were trying to simplify the actual theory, and we would have gained nothing in simplifying the actual theory if our test charges arise in the tensor product of the adjoint representation, because then we would have gotten another interesting theory that would have, that's believed would have behaved in essentially the same way, where the detector would always see color singlet combinations rather than whatever you try to put in. But where you would not, in a clean way, be able to separate from the matter-antimatter creation the linear energy. So by putting in, by doing the experiment with quark-anti-quark creation, by doing the experiment with the museum quarks, I don't quite want to draw this picture. Well, okay. This picture goes back to the Big Bang, where they were created by forces stronger than the ones we have today. So now this quark and anti-quark live in separate museums. And the energy isn't available to create anything that will screen them. So now we see what happens due to charges in non-negative gauge theory that aren't screened. To what extent, I'm not going to prove that this is what happens, but I'm trying to explain.
You haven't seen where the pi 1 entered.
No, the pi 1 entered because we use a representation that isn't present in the pure gauge theory. Gauge theory inevitably has the adjoint representation.
Yeah.
And when you quantize the...
Right. It so therefore has. You could use the group SU3 modulo of these things?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, well, yeah. As long as we're on R4, see, I'm going to start out with particle physics on R4. And then after we do some physics, we'll consider non trivial bundles. So, all it means to do the group SU3 mod Z3 is that we will only consider fields, except with explicit notice that we'll warn about, and those will be the museum particles. But all the fields that are actually present in the theory are in representations of SU3 mod Z3. And whenever a representation of SU3 that isn't a representation of SU3 mod Z3 is introduced, we'll think of it as a special impurity over which we have control rather than part of the theory. So this setup here just wouldn't work with the adjoint representation because the flux tube would be able to break. This thing is called a flux tube. It would be able to break by standard matter-antimatter creation. Namely, the theory already has particles in the adjoint representation. A pair of them would be created. I don't think it would shed light if I draw this with a broken flux tube, but a pair would be created, and it would snap into two flux tubes that would shrink. So it's believed that the essence, quark confinement, if you weight things by how interesting they are, together with the imperfection of the understanding, then quark confinement is far out somewhere in left field. It's one of the most interesting and surprising and well-documented yet imperfectly understood phenomenon in nature. It's believed that its essence is that in the theory without dynamical quarks, in the theory which only has museum quarks, there would have been this linear energy between external quarks.
What is the unknown theory of the electromagnetic relativity?
electric field.
Well, this is the condition that says the divergence of E is the generator of gauge transformations in the theory. And rho, this delta function, is the operator, which is just a constant. That's the charge of the electron. So the analogous equation says that the total wave function of the gauge field plus the quark is gauge invariant. But since it's Lie algebra valued and it's non-Hegelian Lie algebra, you can't usefully integrate it to get an elementary statement. That's part of why quark confinement is difficult to understand. Well, so because it is difficult to understand, I want to then, in a little while, give an example of a theory that undergoes the electromagnetic dual of quark confinement. But as practice, I want to first point out something which we've already used in the previous lectures, that taking the gauge group to be SU3 mod Z3 lets us do something else, which is interesting, involving a new kind of museum particle. So, because of the fact that the fundamental group is non-trivial, on a two-sphere, you can have an SU3 mod Z3 bundle labeled by our friends M, the discrete magnetic flux in H2 of S2, with values in pi 1 of G. It's our friend that appeared all the time in the previous lectures, except instead of S2, we had a 2 torus or a 3 torus. Now, what's the problem? Well, in general, if we're below four dimensions, at which point we'd meet pi 3 of this group, such bundles are only non-trivial. Pi 0 and pi 2 are trivial, so they're determined by pi 1. So in this range of dimensions, S2 could be replaced by any 3 manifold here. Well, of course, in standard particle physics, one might think it happens on R3 for space. So there's no S2. In particular, if I put in R3 here, H2 of R3 with values in anything would be trivial. But the Big Bang created holes in space, which are also kept in museums. So, we don't really understand the physics of this, but on a length scale of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, physicists secretly have stored in museums holes in space created in the Big Bang. And we're simply tricking certain science writers into writing articles claiming that string theory could never be tested. Because after they've gone out on print in full, we're going to unveil from our museum vaults these Planck holes in space, which will enable us to amply test all aspects of the theory at Planck scale. But for reasons we don't fully understand but enable us to probe QCD more fully. What? Now, these holes are of various kinds that will enable us to probe all aspects of the theory. But some of them have the property that if you draw a small two-sphere around them, the SU3 mod Z3 gauge bundle, this is really happening in a different branch of the wave function where the quark diameters are tons, enabling us to have the other kind of museum quarks. But some of these two-spheres, little tiny two-spheres, some of these holes have the property that if you draw a two-sphere around them, M restricted to S is not zero. So these things are pretty heavy. We don't have to worry about more of them being created and annihilated. And we move them around at our disposal. So we could call them QCD magnetic monopoles. The motivation for the term is that an ordinary magnetic north pole, if you had one, would be defined by saying that the divergence of the magnetic field, or d of the curvature with the magnetic charge m times the delta function of the position of the magnetic pole. That's what I'm calling x sub n. That says that if you draw a sphere around the magnetic pole, the integral over the sphere at f is equal to m, which is not zero. And f being the curvature on a U1 bundle, that would say that the U1 bundle on a two-sphere surrounding a magnetic pole is non-trivial. So these things would be sort of like QCD magnetic poles. And we notice that they're classified by the group Z3, just as the other ones were. In other words, the interesting electric sources were labeled by representations of SU3 divided by representations of SU3 mod Z3. Because the representations of SU3 mod Z3, since we can make them from gluons, should be considered trivial. So, all told, we label our museum charges by a pair which we could call ME in Z3 times Z3. Well, the first Z3, in any event, if you've got one of these museum charges, you draw a two-sphere around it. And the first Z3, measures the restriction of the SU3 mod Z3 bundle to the two-sphere. And the second measures the representation of all charges inside, modulo charges that can be made by tensor products of the adjoint representation. So I described separately what the two kinds of charges could be, but obviously we could now make combinations. So we could have one of those little magnetic poles, or we could have a quark, and we could bring them together and look at a little sphere that contains both of them. So our charge of our external impurities takes values in Z3 times Z3. Now, I've explained that it's believed that 0e is confined for e not equal 0. I really want to switch to an additive notation, so it's E not equals 0, not E not equals 1. That corresponds to the fact that we don't observe quarks. We don't observe free quarks. It's also believed that M0 is not confined. What this means is that you see, we've got museums that contain the quarks, and we've got museums that contain the monopoles. But the curators need to make quite different efforts in the two cases. Here, there's a flux tube between them with a huge, huge tension, because that constant, what in the world is it in usual units? The energy was a constant times R. And the constant is the QCD length scale, roughly 100 MeV squared, I guess. So, gosh. Anyone want to say how many tons that is at the tension on the string? I'm afraid of trying to convert to tons in real time. So I won't, but I'll accept any offers. Anyway, here they've got to be careful, because if they let their grip slip, the quarks and anti-quarks will float together and annihilate, which would be a pity, because we can't make any more. And also, there'd be a dreadful explosion with tons. Tons of rest mass being converted into radiation. But they let the school children play with the monopoles and anti-monopoles, because there are no forces on those and no danger of losing them. Well, I think we should go on and see why anything would be confined. But introducing this group Z3 times Z3 is done for a purpose. Obviously, the group SL2Z, well, really will only act by its quotient. SL2Z mod 3 will act on Z3 times Z3, exchanging the electrochromatic charges and linear combinations thereof. And part of the story is that one imagines that the actual theory of nature has cousins related to it by the action of SL2Z. So while we live in a world in which this kind of museum quark is confined and these aren't, there might be other worlds with the opposite property, and some of them are easier to understand. So we'll set as our first goal to understand why anything would be confined in any theory. Well, okay. So we'll imagine a world with M0 confined. It won't be our actual world, of course. That would be a world in which quarks would do just fine. And monopoles left over from the Big Bang would have standard strange properties and would have to be kept under careful control in museums. Well, to do this, we add to the SU3 gauge theory several scalars, phi, in the adjoint representation. SU3 mod Z3. Instead of the adjoint, we could use any representation of SU3 mod Z3. We want it to be an SU3 mod Z3 theory. So the scalars we add have to be in representations of SU3 mod Z3. The simplest one to think about, perhaps, is the adjoint representation. Then we take the Lagrangian to be the integral of trace F squared plus the kinetic energy of the scalars plus a gauge invariant potential V of phi. And we pick V of phi to have a minimum on a unique free G orbit. V of phi has its minimum at non-zero phi. Of course, it's G is SU3 mod Z3. The minimum will inevitably be an SU3 mod Z3 orbit. We want the minimum to be a unique and free orbit. Free means that the group is completely broken. In other words, the orbit is a copy of the group, actually. So any given point on the orbit is left fixed only by the identity in the group. By the way, we could have some fun with considering semi-free G orbits that break G down to a finite group. And thereby, we could even find a few counterexamples to some standard claims in literature that I stumbled into when I was worrying about preparing this lecture. But we're not going to. We're only going to consider the case that G is broken down to the identity. So, in that case, to minimize the energy, phi is on this orbit. And that reduces the structure group of the G bundle is reduced to the identity. In other words, as long as phi has its vacuum excitation value up to gauge transformation, it trivializes the G bundle. Now we consider the experiment with the museum monopoles, the holes in space left over from the Big Bang, on the complement of which, on a little sphere around which, or sphere of any size around which, the bundle is non-trivial. See, we've got a problem. Because to minimize the energy, the bundle is supposed to be trivialized, yet it's non-trivial. So, obviously, we can't make the energy essentially zero by putting phi on the preferred orbit. We need to, somewhere on the sphere, phi has got to be in a region which has an unbroken group, a continuous unbroken group. In fact, it's got to be a group with the property that the center, well, that a non-trivial path, the criterion is that you need a region in space, R, such that in this region R, in SU3 mod Z3, but pi 1 was non-trivial. And there's some non-trivial path gamma. Our magnetic flux is determined by non-trivial elements of the group that corresponds to some homotopy class of paths. We actually, to create this bundle, need a subgroup of SU3 mod Z3 into which we can push gamma. So not only does phi have to be something else somewhere in space, but somewhere in space, it's got to be on a G orbit, which is invariant under a subgroup H into which we can push this path gamma. Anyway, the details of that aren't too important. The point is only that there's got to be a region of space in which we're not in the vacuum. So now, we're in the situation that we imagined here, where we imagined that the vacuum expelled electric flux. Here there's a vacuum that forbids magnetic flux because magnetic flux means a non-trivial bundle. And the vacuum trivializes the bundle. So what will happen here is that if you solve the ordinary causal equations of this theory on R3 with two little holes removed, with boundary conditions, they can be any boundary conditions you want as long as they include the fact that the bundle is non-trivial on the holes. What will happen is that a tube in space will form. Away from this tube, you'll be practically on the vacuum orbit. Not exactly, of course, but you'll approach it exponentially. I should have asked here that this was a not unique, free, and non-degenerate orbit. In other words, that this minimum was a non-degenerate in the sense of equivariant Morse theory. That in the normal directions, that the boson mass matrix, which is the Hessian in the normal directions, is non-degenerate. So the theory has a mass gap. And the mass gap means that far away you'll be exponentially close to the vacuum. But there'll be a tube in space in which the gauge group is at least partially restored. Exactly how it will happen will depend on the details of V. And the precise boundary conditions on these spheres will only make an exponentially small influence on what the picture looks like in a limit where the two external charges are far away. In between, you'll make a pure object, which is called a vortex tube. Well, the most important example of this with industrial applications is the case where the gauge group is U1. G is U1, which is an example of a non-simply connected group. It's what we have in electromagnetism. And it's broken down to nothing in a superconductor. Or is it Z2, maybe? Maybe it's broken to Z2 in a superconductor. But anyway, it's the same general idea. Z2 isn't a group into which you can push a non-trivial element of pi 1 of U1. So now, if you set up external, you can't quite do this with magnetic poles, but if you set up external conditions where there's got to be magnetic flux in a superconductor, a region of normal state will form in which the bundle isn't trivialized or its structure group isn't reduced to Z2. And, for example, if you want to use high-temperature superconductors for practical applications, a superconductor is a region of space in which, because of the dynamics of the electrons, the structure group is effectively reduced to Z2 from U1 by something analogous to this, except you need to work harder to figure out what phi is. But if you want to use, for example, high-temperature superconductors for practical purposes, one of your main problems is the formation and slippage of these flux tubes. So I didn't try to do this by first reminding you of the analogy with flux tubes and superconductors, because I felt that the audience was divided between people who knew about the analogy and people to whom it wouldn't be helpful. But on another occasion, one might have started with that analogy. So this is how something gets to be confined. See, in this theory, the energy between a monopole and an antimonopole will grow linearly as you separate them. And it's much harder to understand how quarks get confined. But it's clear that if we can understand how there can be an SL2Z action that maps this theory, for example, if we had a theory that actually was SL2Z invariant, with SL2Z acting in the obvious way on Z3 times Z3, then if that theory had a phase, which means a region of the parameters or a vacuum, that does what I just described, it would have to have another phase with quarks being confined. Even if we don't actually have a SL2Z symmetry that maps a theory to itself, if we have a similar transformation that maps the theory to another theory, with exchange of the two kinds of Musam particles, then the dual of the original theory would have confinement of quarks. So this sort of shows you that confinement of monopoles is possible in a completely concrete way. And if you can understand non-perturbative electric magnetic symmetries that exchange these two, of course, it's a big challenge to really understand them. And we've only become convinced that they exist, really, in the last few years. Then confinement of quarks would have to happen in other models, even though harder to understand. Now, Hooft and others in the late 70s and early 80s made a number of additional observations about this. So, first of all, confinement of M0 happens because of what's informally, at least, called condensation of 0E. The fact that an electrically, I'm going to put the whole sentence in quotes, an electrically charged field phi has a vacuum expectation value. So it's kind of clear what that means in the classical limit. Well, we don't know how to talk about magnetic monopoles as fields we can add to Lagrangians. See, for electric charges, I started with a theory that had them, and then we considered a theory that only had them as Musam particles. But the magnetic monopoles, to begin with, we only had as Musam particles. And even if we could, I won't, but we could write a bigger theory that would have magnetic monopoles. But they wouldn't be fields we add to Lagrangian. The fields we add to Lagrangian are electrically charged, for instance, representing the electron. Magnetic monopole fields would have to be fields which, when they act on the vacuum, create a non-trivial bundle around themselves. So the field that was non-zero in the vacuum was electrically charged. So fields of type 0E were electrically charged and M0 was confined. It means in a non-trivial representation of the group. But that's what the E being not zero means. But the zero means that they're not, that they don't carry a magnetic charge. So such a field acting on the vacuum doesn't change the topology, doesn't create a singularity around which the bundle has non-trivial topology. So, well, that's an informal statement because the sentence in quotes could be criticized for several reasons, but the sentence in quotes was certainly a classical formulation. A more far-reaching statement is that on the group Z3 times Z3, there's a natural Z3 valued skew pairing. Maybe we should call this gamma. Well, gamma had another name in the previous lecture, so I'll call it capital N, maybe. So N times N going to Z3. Well, I was wondering if I should explain that. When fields don't have expectation values, you can count the corresponding particles. You quantize a field to get particles. The particles carry the quantum numbers of the field. And you can, if they, let's say, to be simple, if you're in a situation where everything has a mass and the symmetry is unbroken, you can count 1, 2, 3 particles. A field having an expectation value in a space of infinite volume is like putting into the vacuum infinitely many particles, filling up space, after which you can no longer count the particles. So you have to think of the vacuum as containing an indefinite number of particles of type phi. And after that, one more or less isn't noticed, even if it's a fraction. So a quark carries certain weights of SU3, which are fractional multiples of the weights in the adjoint representation. But once we've condensed, I remember how hard it was in my, as a graduate student in the early part of my postgraduate career, to understand what people meant when they said something had condensed. So I don't think there's any way I can fully convey it to you in a sentence or two. But once something has condensed in the vacuum, you give an expectation value to such a field. If we were writing down quantum field functionals, we'd have to create a state with phi not zero from a state with phi zero, we'd have to act on the vacuum with the exponential of an operator that creates phi particles. And that would create an indefinite number of phi particles, which would be really infinite as well as indefinite in infinite volume. And after that, you can't count them sensibly. So phi had E equals 0 mod 3. But the mod 3 won't do us any good if phi is condensed. We perhaps should set this up with the SU3 and SU3 mod Z3 root lattices both. Anyway, I oversimplified the imprecise statement. On Z3 times Z3, there's a natural Z3 valued skew pairing. Okay. I'm not going to try to fix the notation. But you can imagine here we're introducing lattices and dual lattices. So on Z3 times E3, there's a natural Z3 valued skew pairing, bilinear skew pairing, which is completely determined by the fact that 1, 0 times 0, 1 maps to 1. By bilinearity and also skew symmetry, that determines it. So, this pairing has got a physical meaning. If you've got a museum charge, which is a monopole, that means that around it you've got an SU3 mod Z3 bundle. The bundle is determined by an element of the center of SU3. And now if you've got a charge, that center acts somehow. So to evaluate, what this one means is that you take the element of the center that determines this bundle, and you act with it on that representation, and you get 1 mod 3. So there's a natural pairing. And we could introduce the Houghton-Wilson loop operators and see that pairing in their combination relations. But I don't want to do it because of time. I want to get back inside to the three twice. And Hooft makes the observations, well, he sort of only formulated it using the fact that 3 was a prime number. So I'll restate it a little bit more generally. 1d3 times z3. The condensed charges. Or in an isotropic subgroup and inside M. Isotropic means that this pairing is zero when restricted to the condensed charges. The condensed charges are all electric, and electric charges are all multiples of 0, 1, and the skew symmetry means that the pairing is zero on those. And a charge x and m is confined if and only if I just have a maximal isotropic. So maximal means that the condensed charges, which are of type 0a, have zero self-pairings, but anything else you'd add to them would have a non-zero pairing with one of them. A charge x is confined if and only if x paired with n is not zero. But that's the same as x not in n, because n was maximal. So, then under SL2Z, well, if we did this with SUN, then we would have had ZN times ZN. And it's then actually not true unless N is prime that SL2Z creates all maximal isotropic subgroups, starting from the one we gave. But if you follow through the logic in the old derivations, they tell you that the condensed charges should be given by a maximal isotropic subgroup of ZN times ZN. It doesn't have to be ZN times ZN. It's pi 1 times pi 1. In SO4N, pi 1 isn't cyclic. And to turn it into pi 1 times pi 1, we've got to make a natural identification. Well, that was explained the other day by John, between pi 1 and pi 1 star. But we'll skip that. Yeah, but we need that. Okay, but we want. Okay, for most of these statements, we don't need it. But then we want to say that SL2Z might act. That's. It was at the same point, wanting to exchange M and E, but for a slightly different reason. I wrote down something where we needed to be able to exchange the two groups the other day. Okay. Well, the general logic of this leads us to imagine new phases where the condensed charges are in a maximal isotropic subgroup and everything else is confined. Well, now, the phases that are called confining, where it means that 0e is not in n for all non-zero e. If you want all electric charges to be confined, that means 0e is never in n. Well, and we'll also consider the case where pi 1 is zn for simplicity. N is generated by 1f for some f. So there are n possible confining phases that you detect by this classification. This is a more refined classification than just saying if the theory is confining or not. This decomposes confining phases into n different types. I actually don't think it's a complete classification, but it's certainly a more refined classification. Well, to make contact with the, maybe before I make contact with the earlier lectures, we'll, I'll stop here for questions. The subgroup generated by 1F. F is a fixed number. Okay. F is a fixed number, and we consider the subgroup generated by 1F. So we get N phases. So 1-0 is called pure confinement. And 1F with F not 0 is oblique confinement. Maybe I'll give an example of this, but I won't have time to explain it. If you take SU2 gauge theory with N equals 2 supersymmetry, then the moduli space of Acura is the U-plane, which Seiberg and I studied. And there are two singularities at 1 and minus 1. Now you, if you perturb slightly, to N equals 1 via a term in the superpotential, which is trace phi squared. The N equals 1 theory, well, if you add trace phi squared with a very big coefficient and get rid of the phi field, you'll get rid of the phi field completely and reduce to the pure N equals 1 theory, which I lectured about in the first three lectures. But if you add it with a small, you can argue that for qualitative purposes, it doesn't matter if you perturb slightly or a lot using holomorphy and R symmetries. If you perturb slightly, you can analyze what happens. You get two vacua, one of which is near U equals 1 and one is near U equals minus 1. And at U equals 1, remember at U equals 1 and U equals minus 1, there's a massless monopole or dion in the description. So here there's a massless, in the N equals 2 level, there's a massless monopole. A monopole meant a 1-0 charge. And here there's a massless dion. The term dion just means MF with M and F both not zero. Whereas monopole means M0 with M not zero. So at the N equals 2 level, there was a massless monopole or a massless dion. But under the slight perturbation, the U-plane disappears, one's left with two vacua, in one of which the monopole condensed and in the other of which the dion condensed. So you get two vacua, one of which has ordinary confinement and one has oblique confinement. So this was a concrete realization of some of the old ideas about the different confining phases and how they would be achieved by letting a magnetic monopole or a dion condense. The point was that what you can see explicitly to start with in the classical description is a ordinary field in some representation of the gauge group that gets an expectation value. Here, after a long song and dance, the magnetic monopole becomes massless and eventually gets an expectation value, giving an electric magnetic dual of the original phase. And for the SU2 theory, we got both possibilities, 1-0 and 1-1. So that's a concrete situation in which you can see confinement and oblique confinement happening. Now, any questions now before I try to make contact with the other lectures? So, M not equal zero meant that on a two-sphere, we had a non-trivial bundle. We started with SU3 mod Z3, but we generalized it to any non-simply connected group. But we had a non-trivial bundle in the two-sphere. And magnetic confinement meant that there was necessarily somewhere in the two-sphere a non-zero energy, which there... Now, we did not discuss exactly the same problem in our lectures. Here today I've lectured about R3 minus a hole. And we had the two spheres surrounding the hole. But in our lectures we had T3. We wrote it as T2 times T1. And we had M restricted to T2 being not zero. we should worry about whether changing the topology of the two-cycle on which the bundle is non-trivial matters. In general, it can. Yes. But you see, the mechanism I gave for confinement of magnetic monopoles, where you completely break the gauge group, works independently of the topology. Whatever the topology of the two-cycle is, whatever the topology of the two-cycle is, you'd get a non-zero energy if you try to, well, have a non-trivial bundle in a theory where minimizing the energy requires trivializing the bundle. So, this is a good criterion. Studying this situation is a good criterion for studying whether we are in a phase where the bundle is completely trivialized. So, for instance, we found a non-zero index, which we called T of M0. We find T of M0 non-zero for M not equal zero. We computed that for small volume, but since it was an index, it was also the same for large volume. So this demonstrates that the theory is not in a phase in which the gauge group is completely broken. That's a non-trivial statement about the dynamics. Now, likewise, well, you see, when I discussed electric charge, we had sources Q and Q bar with electric flux running between them somehow. In our lecture, we trapped electric flux on T2 times T1. Our zero E states were quite similar to this, except that the separation, except that the quark-antiquark pair, the antiquark was taken all the way around the big circle and then annihilated with the quark. And we studied what was left behind. And also, we compactified the normal directions to a two torus. So, heuristically, if electric flux is trapped into a small tube between a quark and antiquark, then you'd expect that in the somewhat similar topology that we studied, T of 0, E being 0, appears to be a consequence of having a large energy associated with electric flux, even though our topological situation was different. Neither statement is really rigorous, because you can definitely find phases of gauge theories in which the change in the global topology where you're probing the electric or magnetic flux matters. Unfortunately, so, well, I suspect that what you understand least, at least if you've never heard this stuff before, is why the electric flux that I gave lecture about today is similar to the one we had in the previous lectures. So I think I'd better focus on explaining that rather than why the statements aren't completely rigorous. Well, there isn't a phi in this theory. We're more abstract. We gave, for a simple theory we could analyze, I gave a theory with a phi and a v, and where the classical approximation was good. And then that theory was in a phase where a magnetic flux is confined. It carries an irreducible energy. By showing that the index was not something we actually proved here, by computing that the index to be not zero when you have magnetic flux, is that the supersymmetric QCD is not in a phase like that. There are other things it could be in, despite that calculation, which we think it isn't in. But it's not in that kind of phase. It's possible that by considering a Riemann surface times T1 and twisting the theory to keep some supersymmetry, and then showing that showing by the same kind of calculation that the index is still not zero, that you could dispose, you might be able to get a better argument. But I don't know. That would take some thought. Well, I feel there are all kinds of gaps in what I've said, but to me the biggest one is that, oh, I think that the analogy between magnetic fluxes I defined it on Monday and magnetic fluxes we had it today was clear. Namely, you had a non-trivial bundle on a two-sphere or a two-torus, which clearly are somewhat similar. I feel that the analogy between the electric flux of today and that of Monday might be completely mysterious. So that's the point I want to explain. So what it means to do gauge, well, first of all, in gauge theories in general, the vacuum is supposed to be a gauge invariant state. Well, what is an example of a gauge invariant state? Well, a state is a function of connections. Except, if you add external charges, you have a function of connection, tensors with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, R and R bar, which are SU3 modules where the charges live. So we need to give an element of functions on connection tensored with R and R bar, which is gauge invariant. That's what it means to have a gauge invariant state. There's something I'm about to write down which one conceivably could have started the lecture with. Because if I just ask you to make a gauge invariant one of those, you're going to have trouble, I believe. And your trouble might lead you to suspect quark confinement. Well, there isn't time now to properly set it as a homework problem. But I'd have wanted to set this problem to the mathematicians. Take the space functions of connections on a free manifold, tensored with two finite dimensional SU3 modules. What would you come up with for the most obvious gauge invariant state? If we didn't have the SU3, if we just had functions of connections, I think hopefully you'd come back with one as the most obvious gauge invariant function of connections. Otherwise, you should practice more at reducing to the previous case. So here, the most obvious, which I think you'd have come back with, is to pick a curve between Q and Q bar. And then take what we might call just Q bar times parallel transport along this curve times Q. What it means is that parallel transport gives an operator from R to R bar, which we can think of as a vector in R bar tensor R. So the parallel transport from one to the other gives us an invariant vector in here, as I hope is clear. Well, that vector looks like the vacuum except along the curve. So the electric flux is concentrated on the curve, and that, therefore, will have infinite energy. So our attempt at writing an obvious gauge invariant state with a quark and an antiquark gave an example where the electric flux was completely collapsed along the curve. Now, I believe if I asked you as mathematicians or physicists, anybody, no matter who you are, I think if I ask you to write down a reasonable candidate for a gauge invariant state that doesn't look like it describes confinement, you'd undoubtedly have lots of trouble. And in the process, you'd be retracing some of the steps by which, in the mid-70s, people became more accustomed to the notion of confinement. At any rate, an example of a state that has electric charge, I make no further advertisement for it at the moment, is this parallel transport between two points. Now, if you start with the vacuum and act on it with this operator, because this being a function of the data could be thought of as an operator on states, if you act on it with this operator, you get a state that has infinite energy. The question of confinement, though, is whether that energy, whether the electric flux could spread, and whether the system in time would radiate away all that infinite energy and relax to a low energy state that's also gauge invariant. But anyway, this certainly is an example of the kind of state we're discussing when we discuss quark confinement. So what we had in the earlier lectures was we took T2 times T1, and we had a fancy definition of what it was a state carrying electric flux. It had to do with the character of a certain finite group. But if I asked you concretely to give an example of a state like that, The simplest example you would give would be to start with the state 1 that doesn't have electric flux, and then act on it with a trace of the holonomy around C. Which physicists write this way. As I explained in one of the lectures, the trace of the holonomy around C is an example of a state, well, an operator which acting on a state which changes the electric flux in the, by the definition we had Monday. Acting on a state without electric flux. This is in a representation of SU3 that's not in an SU3 mod Z3 representation. So the gauge transformations that only make sense in SU3 mod Z3 and not in SU3 don't leave it invariant. And that was our definition of electric flux. Well, intuitively, confinement is a local statement that putting in this kind of operator creates something in the vacuum that just can't spread. And intuitively, one would feel, I actually don't think this is universally true, but intuitively one would feel that if it's the case as a local statement that this kind of electric flux can't spread, you'll see exactly the same thing when you put it in a box, which is what we did. Instead of a holonomy on a finite path ending on some finite vector spaces, we had a holonomy all the way around the circle. So to the extent that the global topology of C doesn't matter, our calculation that T of 0e is 0 is a symptom of confinement. Confinement means that putting in that electric flux actually carries a big energy, so in particular it doesn't have zero energy. Well, what's oblique confinement? Oblique confinement says, well, first of all, our SUN theory, which is the example I want to give to close up briefly, has these N vacua. Evidently, they're all confining. So T of 0e being 0 means all vacua are confining. Zero E is never condensed. But for N equals 1, remember that on the second lecture, before we did a serious calculation yesterday, we practiced with a baby calculation where the moduli space was a point. And in that calculation, we found T of 1e was not 0 for all e. Well, that means that with 1 unit of magnetic flux, that's an oversimplification, sorry. We found that there were n values of E. When we computed T of 1, 0, we had to look at a certain moduli space that had n points and was acted on by the finite group. So it gave n states. And when we took characters, there were n characters for which T of 1, E was non-zero. I didn't actually figure out which ones there were. But if you do work that out, you'll see that T of 1e is not 0 if e is a multiple of m. So by a certain duality, remember, m lived in two different isomorphic groups, but by a certain duality, they were actually isomorphic after using a relation between pi 1 of g and pi 1 star of g. So it makes sense. Well, n is 1. This is true in general, though, although we didn't demonstrate it. T of m e, more generally, we didn't demonstrate it except for m equals 1. But T of m e is non-zero if e is a multiple of m for all m. We actually showed that if m is prime to n. But by continuing with the more sophisticated calculation we did yesterday, when m isn't prime to n, after a little while, you would have learned this. T So I didn't do the calculation to show that the characters were T of ME or not zero. Or T of 1E, let's say, is not zero for N characters. Okay. Remember what I mean by multiple. We were on the 3 torus. So after using a duality, M and E both take values in H2 of the 3 torus with values in pi 1 of J. So that's an abelian group with 3 generators if pi 1 is cyclic. And when I speak of M being 1, we considered the case where it was pulled back from a 2 torus. So not all E's are multiples of that. Only N of them are, in the case where the group is SUN. If done more carefully, our calculations show that T, in general, T of ME is not zero if and only if E is a multiple of N equals 1. So that means that in the presence of magnetic flux, electric flux is not confined in all vacua. So our result means, at least heuristically, that for every F, there is a vacuum in this thing with one F unconfined. In making this statement, F is just a number because I'm now back in our group. N equals Zn times Zn. So 1 means we have 1 museum charge of magnetic monopole. And F means we've got F museum quarks. And here we measure the charges by little 2 spheres. And because the topology is being changed from S2 to T2, the relation to our computation isn't rigorous. But heuristically, and usually, if the simplest things happen, the topology here doesn't matter. Finding the non-zero index with the 1e parallel charges corresponds to having on R3 finite energy for the 1f combination. So our computations correspond to one of the vacua having oblique confinement of each kind. We had n vacua because H was n for SUN. And there are n possible values of F. So there's one vacuum with each kind of oblique confinement. I think I'll stop here, presuming that some of you might be almost as tired as me. Well, you can use the same method. If you're willing to ignore the difference in topology of S2 and T2, then you can use the same method to determine which phases arise for all the exceptional groups. I actually worked it out, but the answer is too complicated to remember the details of where to briefly summarize. And I didn't have any intuitive understanding of it. But, I mean, for SUN is the only case where H is equal to the order of the fundamental group. So the statement that there's one vacuum of each kind could only be true for SUN. I think, for example, for SO2N plus 1, there are 2 kinds of conceivable confining vacua, but only one of them arises. And for the other groups, you find other answers. Any other questions? The methods are the same. For given N, you find the zero-energy states, as I told you yesterday, and then you see how the finite group gamma, that whose characters are the electric fluxes, acts on it. Well, I didn't, and I can't guarantee that nobody could have. I do know another way to do it for SO2N plus 1 that gives the same answer. Seidberg and Schilligator studied an N equals 1 theory with additional matter, and by analyzing the U-plane, they showed it had 2 singular points. But when you and one had confinement and one had oblique confinement. But by perturbing down to this theory, one of them gets killed. So from that point of view, you again expect only one of the 2 abstractly possible phases in this theory. By the way, this could be done for all groups in a completely different way. By taking the N equals 2 curves, which are known for all groups, And then working very hard, I might say, for E7 or something like that. Well, the analog of this U-plane story is known for all the simple E-groups. So, as I explained about a little while ago, taking the U-plane with its two singularities and studying what happened near them, those are the two singularities that give the two terms in writing Donaldson invariants in terms of SW invariants when B2 plus is bigger than 1. Anyway, those two singularities are associated with the two kinds of phases. So, for a general simple Lie group, instead of the U plane, you've got a complex manifold of dimension R, in fact, a copy of CR, that parameterizes a family of rank R abelian varieties. And there's a discriminant in there, and there are H normal crossing points of the discriminant of maximum order. They correspond to these two singularities. And by studying the physics near the H, for example, 18, I think, for E7, normal crossing points. So for E7, the rank is 7, so there would be 7-fold intersections, I guess. There are 6-fold intersections of the discriminant. It has 18 6-fold transverse intersections with itself, you'd write the Donaldson invariants for E7 when B2 plus is bigger than 1 as a sum over contributions from those 18 points. And if you perturb it slightly down to n equals 1, those 18 points will be deformed into the 18 vacua that we've been detecting in a different way by computing trace minus 1 to the F1 of 3 torus and seeing that it was 18. And by studying the charges of the particles that would condense there, you'd get an answer of some kind, which you could compare with what I've computed from trace minus 1 to the F. I'm not personally going to try to do it, because although there is a perfectly concrete description of what the family of abelian varieties is for E7, I wouldn't personally have the techniques to really describe exactly what was happening near those normal crossing points and boil it down to a description of whether you had confinement or oblique confinement. But it could be done, and it would be very interesting to compare it with what is gotten by the methods I've been lecturing about, pursuing them a bit further. Not to mention the fact that if you mathematicians would start calculating Donaldson invariants for E7, or four manifolds of B2 plus bigger than 1, then you could compare them to the formulas that would come this way.
Could you formulate once again the connection between confinement and compensation that you really say would like to understand how precise this connection is?
Well, you see, until the last few years, for example, I was skeptical because the argument seemed vague. The assertion was that if you had an electromagnetic symmetry, or even if you didn't have such a symmetry, you might have a theory that was related to monopoles the way the Higgs mechanism is related to confinement. The Higgs mechanism is related to ordinary fields. But, well, since I turned out to be wrong, I don't want to press my point too vigorously, but given the difficulty of finding examples, it seemed a little bit vague. Although there were lattice examples in abelian theories, which in hindsight were better models than they might have seemed. I'm not certain I've answered you.
No.
You imagine that there's a symmetry where monopoles behave the way ordinary fields behave in the theory that I actually wrote down concretely. And then that theory would confine electric charge just like the other one confines non-trivial bundles or magnetic charge.
So I understand the state in particular examples, but you made a very general statement.
Yes.
And
I made a very general statement, which I put in quotes at the key point, admitting that it was vague. Right. Where I put it in quotes was when I talked about the condensation of a charged field, which is somewhat imprecise because it's a classical notion which is hard to make precise in quantum theory. It can be made precise for a family of theories. I'll tell you now the most critical statement I would have made 15 years ago about vague thoughts about such symmetries. So, to make precise the notion of an electric field condensing, It doesn't make sense for fixed H-bar. It's only sense it makes sense in a classical limit. So if you have a family of theories that generates to a classical limit, you can make a precise sense of saying that asymptotically near that limit, a charge field has condensed. And therefore, you can make inferences about qualitative properties like confinement anywhere that's connected without a phase transition to that limit. So therefore, by symmetry, to make sense out of an assertion about confinement via monopole condensation, you need a family of theories where monopoles are becoming semi-classical, and you can make a precise statement about monopoles condensing. So we can now make that kind of thing precise sometimes, although certainly not usually. For instance, if we could do that for QCD, for the real theory of strong interactions, I'd have lectured about that this week instead of beating around the bush talking about computing a supersymmetric index. But to make the statements I put in quotes precise, you need a family of theories that's degenerating to a limit where monopoles can be treated classically, either because they're becoming light or because the whole theory is becoming weakly coupled in a description with monopole fields. Any other questions? Yes?
Is it relevant that there are theories where you have so many matter multiples that you no longer have confinement?
Yes, I didn't claim that all theories have confinement. Mm-hmm. Neither did I claim that all theories had any of the things I talked about. I didn't emphasize it enough during the lecture, but Hoeff's classification was a classification for phases that had a mass gap. So what you're asking about will actually lead to having massless particles. Mm-hmm. If you have so many fields that at low energies you have a non-asymptotically free gauge group with massless matter, then that theory at long distances will look like a classical theory with the massless fields. It'll have none of the things we talked about, neither the Higgs mechanism nor confinement. So I left out some of the arguments and didn't explain. Well, I explained why we could imagine certain phases. A more complete description would have shown that massless theories didn't fit anywhere on that list. It was a useful classification. Massless theories would be, in general, the case where none of the charges are either condensed or confined. Well, a way of stating it, which would be more universal, is that if something condenses, then anything that doesn't commute with it is confined. And if what condenses will always, therefore, be, is always isotropic. But if what condenses isn't maximally isotropic, then the theory doesn't have a mass gap. I really probably should have stated it that way in the lecture.
The only reason why I bring it up is that you might get the impression, listening to your lecture,
yeah,
that all you need is a non-Abelian gauge group, and then you automatically have confinement. I know.
No, it was much more precise. We started with a particular theory.
Right.
But the case you're asking about is the case where nothing is condensed or confined. So what I called N is zero, which is certainly an isotropic group. So, in fact, one of the ways, actually the way I wrote it before using the fact that N was maximally isotropic was correct. The confined things are the ones. So, that's a more general statement. If N is confined, well, N is isotropic. N is confined if and only if N with N is not zero. And three, that a mass gap implies that N is maximal isotropic. That's a more complete statement than I gave in the lecture. Yes? What's a tensor multiple? Oh, you mean anti-symmetric tensor in four dimensions? Well.
No, I mean six dimensions.
Oh, in six dimensions? Oh, thanks. Well, I'd probably better not say no, but I guess I could say we only understand the Coulomb phase for those guys. I don't know what else they can do. Any other questions? Okay.